The President's Commission on Election Integrity met this week. This hour, we talk about it with Iowa's Secretary of State. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Secretary of State Paul Pate is due to join us for a few minutes, also to talk about accommodation for voters with disabilities. Also talk with the CEO of an Iowa body armor company that visited the White House this week, Iowa Public Radio's Amy Mayer on a case of mad cow disease in the country, how a lack of rain and heat are impacting corn and soybeans, a recent court ruling that could expand special education services to more Iowa students, and remembering the first moon landing 48 years ago today. Five minutes before your news buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Handful of quick conversations to end this week, as we like to do on News Buzz Fridays. Glad you're along toward the end of the hour, because it was, I was mistaken, it wasn't today, but it was 48 years ago yesterday that the first moon landing took place in 1969. We'll be remembering Iowa's part, as a matter of fact, Collins Radio of Cedar Rapids' part in that moon landing a little bit later in the program. Also, a recent court ruling that could expand special education services to more Iowa students. We'll hear about that. Also, a crop report, how the lack of rain and heat are impacting corn and soybeans. Also, how these warm nights, have you seen how the temperatures really haven't gone down on some nights, down below 80 degrees? Iowa Public Radio's Amy Mayer will be along talking about that one case, perhaps you caught it, of mad cow disease in Alabama, and sort of the alarms that sets off and the precautions we take to make sure that doesn't spread here in the United States. We had hoped to talk with Secretary of State Paul Pate in the first part of this program. Right now, we're having a little trouble connecting with the Secretary of State, so we hope to join him in just a few minutes. Until we do, let's listen to this segment conversation I recorded earlier today. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you may remember this scene from the 1964 Clint Eastwood Western classic, A Fistful of Dollars. The man with no name, of course, played by Clint Eastwood, faces off against a half-dozen armed adversaries, and he tells their leader to aim for his heart.
The heart, Ramon. Don't forget the heart. Aim for the heart or you'll never stop me.
Well, of course, the man with no name then pulls back his poncho to reveal a metal plate strapped to his chest. Body armor has come a long way since that 1964 Clint Eastwood film. Joining us to talk about it, Blake Waldrop. Blake Waldrop is co-owner and CEO of RMA Armament here in Iowa. He's a former Dysart police officer, also a U.S. Marine Corps veteran. Blake, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You had a big week. The White House declared this week Made in America Week, a week-long focus on American-produced goods, and you were invited to the White House.
Yes, it was quite a whirlwind experience being invited.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the body armor that your company makes.
Sure. Well, we make two different kinds of body armor, level 3 and level 4. For those who aren't familiar with the industry, level 3 can defeat all your common rifle threats out there, and level 4, which is the highest grade of body armor that can be produced, level 4 defeats all your steel core rounds that are out there.
Mm-hmm. So give us an idea also for people who aren't really into guns, don't understand the power behind high caliber bullets. How much force is being stopped by your body armor?
Oh, it's I always joke and tell people it's equivalent to standing on railroad tracks and getting hit by a train. So, you know, high caliber rifles produce, you know, 2,000-3,000 pounds of energy upon impact. So it's a pretty nasty punch getting hit. But you know, when you know, people think it's a misconception, you know, wearing an armor plate, you know, if you do take a bullet in the plate, you know, all will be fine. That's actually not factual. You will definitely have broken ribs and cracked sternum and a very bad day, but you will also be alive. That's a lot of energy to stop, you know, especially when something's moving at, you know, almost 3,000 feet or some rounds over 3,000 feet per second, and it stops in under half an inch. That's a lot of moving force stopping immediately. So of course there's going to be some residual effects.
Mm-hmm. So how does it do that? You have these very light plates. And they stop these bullets. How? Can you explain a little bit of the physics here?
Sure, exactly. There's numerous materials on the market, but you know, the materials themselves are inefficient. It's how they're put together, how they're compressed, how they're laid up, what type of heat tonnage and time and pressure that you know you use to make these. So it's a lot of it's material manipulation to get what you want, and it's. I can't say too much without giving away the farm, but you know, it's just a lot of how you manipulate the materials in the manufacturing process to achieve what type of bullet that you want to defeat. Mm-hmm. So that's and a lot of it has to do with the ceramics that are in front of it too. So I always tell people that you know the ceramics job in the front of the plate is to physically break the round into you know thousands of little pieces, and the rest of the kinetic energy that's left gets soaked up by the backer, the plate, which is usually polyethylene, or some people think it's Kevlar, but it's not. Kevlar just works for handgun munitions. Kevlar is terrible for rifle rounds. So, you know, the polyethylene backer that's behind the ceramic acts as, in layman's terms, acts as a catcher's mitt. So it disperses the rest of that energy that's left over once the round is physically broken by the ceramic. So it's like a twofold system to defeat a bullet.
Mm-hmm. Your company is very successful with its body armor. Give us some settings where it's used. Who uses it?
Well, we've got armor all over the United States. We fulfilled hundreds of agencies around the country. We've got a patch wall that we started last year, and I regrettably should have started that 3-4 years ago because we would have had quite a bit more. But just since July 1st of last year, so I mean, you know, we're talking just over a year. We've fulfilled over 100 agencies around the country, and you know that's just departments that we've fulfilled.
There's so these are police departments, for instance.
Oh yes, absolutely, and we've had some federal agencies buy from us too. But the majority of our customer base right now is law enforcement. So either the individual police officer buys, or the departments buy as a whole, which. Before last year was not common at all. Sadly, it has become common because if you remember the unfortunate chain of events that happened last July and August when all the police officers were getting murdered in you know Dallas and Baton Rouge and all the riots were going on, you know, the Ferguson riots and Baltimore riots, so that, you know, police officers getting injured and killed on the job sparked the need for it in the police administration's budgets to put in hard armor, which never was before. So we saw an uptick of business. Sadly, it had to come off those unfortunate events that took place. But now we see a lot of departments actually budgeting for hard armor like they haven't before.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about your White House visit earlier this week. Did you meet President Trump, Vice President Pence?
Yes, I did. I met them both a couple times, and I also got to meet Sean Spicer, the press secretary, and Kellyanne Conway. I had a couple of really good conversations with Mrs. Conway. She's a very, very intelligent lady. So the whole experience was, to us, is like equivalent to climbing Mount Everest.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't think we're ever going to top it.
Well, what was your exchange? What did you talk about with the president? What words did you exchange?
The president was very brief. I talked a little bit with the vice president, not too much, because they're on the move. I mean, they're quick. They got places to go and things to do. So my actual conversations lasted a lot longer with Kellyanne Conway than it ever did with the president and vice president. I just chit-chatted with the president a little bit. Obviously, I told him I was a supporter, and he thanked me for that. And he kind of, you know, when he came around the second time, he kind of sized me up. I'm 6'5" and 300 pounds, so I'm kind of a big guy. So when he circled around the second time around, he sized me up and down and kind of smiled and gave me an extra hard handshake, and then kind of fist bumped me in the chest and smiled. And, you know, I told him that I'm a huge supporter, and he whispered under his breath, "Thank you very much for that," and patted me on the arm. So, and the vice president circled around and thanked me for being a Marine, thanked me for the service to our country, which I was kind of blown away by that. And so I told him, of course, "Thank you, Mr. Vice President," and chit-chatted with him for just a second, and then that was that. So.
Okay. Blake Waldrop, thank you very much. Co-owner and CEO of RMA Armament, an Iowa company. Blake invited to represent his company this week at the White House. I want to thank you for your service to our country as a Marine Corps veteran, and good luck with your business.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. President Trump's Advisory Commission on Election Integrity held its first public meeting this week. This was the commission proposed by the president earlier this year to investigate his belief that as many as 5 million people voted illegally last November. Now, that's an allegation dismissed as unfounded by the vast majority of the nation's election officials and experts. Also in the news about elections, concerns about voting system hacking. And it is National Voters with Disabilities Week. That's why we've asked Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate to join us for a few minutes. Secretary of State Pate, thank you again for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
I wanted to get to the Disabilities Week for voters, but before that, a couple of things, as I'm sure you're aware of in the news concerning elections. What has been the nature of your communication with this Advisory Commission on Election Integrity set up by the president?
Well, the only formal connection, if you will, is they sent a letter to all of us, Secretary of State's, early on requesting some information regarding registration, voter registration rolls. But informally, our National Association of Secretary of State just recently met, and we had some discussions about what and where we should be helping in regards to assuring Americans of the integrity of our system. But we've had no real formal contact with them. We said the original letter, and then, of course, recently we were told not to respond to their letter because there was a court challenge in regards to the information they were asking for.
Mm-hmm. So how did you, as Secretary of State in charge of voting in this state, and Iowa election officials react to those requests? Have those requests been met? Has it been sharing of just public information or any private information under any conditions?
Well, I think the letter was, in my opinion, was poorly written, to say the least, because the author of it, being a Secretary of State himself, should know, and I believe does know, that no state's going to share Social Security information or their confidential information like driver's license, ID, and frankly, nobody knows how you vote either. That's one of the things that people keep asking. Are you telling them how we voted? Well, no, because we don't know either. But the majority of the commissioners of elections and secretaries of state have declined to provide the private information. Most of them have said, if you wish the information, here is our state's policy or our code. And I have not formally responded to them, but I did put out a formal statement right from the very beginning indicating that we don't give out Social Security numbers and we don't give out personal information like your driver's license number and things of that nature. But there is some information that's available to political parties and candidates and media outlets when they request voter lists. There's a policy and a procedure, but even those lists, again, don't include this confidential information.
Mm-hmm. On Wednesday, as part of this first public meeting of the President's Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, President Trump repeated these unfounded allegations of widespread voter fraud. He also suggested, I'm sure this caught your ear, that states not cooperating with his Election Integrity Commission because of their own laws may be somehow involved in sort of, I don't know, untoward electoral behavior. Let's listen to the part of his comments that pertains to that.
I'm pleased that more than 30 states have already agreed to share the information with the Commission and the other states. That information will be forthcoming. If any state does not want to share this information, one has to wonder what they're worried about. And I asked the Vice President, I asked the Commission, what are they worried about? There's something. There always is.
Okay, the President just a couple days ago. What do you think, Secretary Pate, of the President's view here that the states may be hiding something?
Well, I don't know what his intentions were or what his real meaning behind his statement. I'm going to give him the benefit and say that I think he's referring to the basic information that we give out now is what he's asking from all the states. And as I've stated in our case, if that's what they formally request, we will share the procedure that they will be able to get that information, but it won't be the information like Social Security numbers and all that other confidential information. I do believe there might be a few states that just simply aren't going to cooperate with the Commission for whatever their reasons are, and he might be referring to those. But this is a presidential commission. This is not the first one. There have been others in the past. The positive that I'm taking from this is the first time a presidential commissions have actually asked secretaries of state, the ones who run the elections in their states, to be a part of that commission. And we have Democrat and Republican secretaries who are serving on that. And these are past presidents of our national group. And I had conversations with them, and they're very committed to trying to see how we can help give Americans the assurances that we are doing everything possible to protect that process. And in fairness, I think the story is bigger than this. I don't think it's about someone trying to formally manipulate the elections by hacking in. It's really, I think, unfortunately, a major campaign by groups outside of our state and country to question the integrity of the process, to actually disenfranchise people so they don't go vote.
The Russians primarily here.
The Russians are part of it, but I got to tell you that there's more than that. If you want to talk about hacking, there's always people out there who are just they're crooks. There are people out there constantly trying to steal personal data. You can ask anyone in business or state government. That's a major problem they all face. But what we're focusing on right now through the presidential commission is probably mostly the fact that the Russians potentially are trying to, I believe, disenfranchise Americans so that they don't vote because they think their vote is being counted or that somehow the system
right.
isn't on the up and up. And I know what's going on in my state, and I can tell you right now, and there's nobody who's hacking into our system and changing your vote or changing the outcome of an election. But they are doing a darn good job of creating this media or the PR problem to disenfranchise people. So we have to work overtime, and that's part of why these secretaries are serving on this commission is if there's a way we can step up and assure them that we've done all these procedures, all the better.
Mm-hmm. The Homeland Security Secretary, John Kelly, mm-hmm. said this week that states that aren't asking Washington for help in protecting their election systems from hackers are, to use his words, nuts, he said. Is Iowa asking for protection, for help from Washington in protecting our system here in Iowa? Now, to be clear, the voting systems are the domain of our states, right?
They most certainly are, and I'm disappointed in the secretary. I think that if he seriously wants our cooperation, he ought to show up at our meeting. He sent a representative to our national meeting who was generous enough to sit in the meeting, but he didn't have a single answer for any of us when we asked the hard questions about is this a one-way street, because we're providing you the information, meaning the Homeland Security, but you're not necessarily communicating with us. And what it's done is it's eroding credibility. It is making it difficult for us to be proactive when they cite that there were 20 instances of some potential hacking going on, and they don't share it with us. That's frustrating. At least they can do is say, "Hey, you're not one of them. if they have, that's a case. I find it very frustrating that Homeland Security has not done a good job on working with the states. We had a reasonable working relationship prior to this cycle. They would send us information pointing out certain challenges that they were monitoring, and we would take action. So that was appreciated, and we had, I thought, a pretty good track. But with the, and this is two administrations, under President Obama, they started coming in and again, implying things or giving only parts of the information, and it's continued under President Trump, and we're just asking them, they need to sit down at the table with us, they need to give us the security clearance so that we can do our jobs because we're running these elections. And I've not seen any information that has shown that any single state has had anyone tamper with their elections to change the results.
Mm-hmm. Two things quickly, in the very short remaining time, Secretary Pate. It's National Voters with Disabilities Week. Quickly,
yes.
Talk about how you are meeting the challenges associated with making sure that voters with disabilities can be accommodated.
Well, it's a very serious issue, you know, with the Help America Vote Act and the outreach we've done over the years for people with disabilities. We still can do more. In our state alone, we have 300,000 Iowans with some types of disabilities. Some of those aren't visible ones. These are people perhaps who have a military background or otherwise who are uncomfortable going into polling sites, but they have special challenges. So we're reaching out to them. This is a week where we're working through the independent living and the access to independence in our state to encourage them to register to vote and be voters. And we're also giving them information on what programs are available to them. One of the examples, I just changed our voter registration forms for those who have vision challenges to bolder and larger print. And that's online as well as printed for people who need those kind of services. We have curbside voting for people who might want that to help them and be enabled and empowered, if you will. We did over 40-some outreach meetings around the state trying to give this information to people, and it's been very successful. But there's about 8% of Americans who have PTSD. That's 24 million people. That's equal to the entire population of Texas. And many of those are veterans. And the one key thing I learned from that process is curbside voting can help them a lot so that they're more comfortable and they will be a voter. We're going to keep plugging along that line because you don't leave anybody behind.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's important here.
Very quickly, before we say goodbye, back to where we started, Donald Trump has repeatedly claimed millions of illegal votes in the 2016 election. He alleges voter fraud deprived him of the popular vote victory. No evidence provided behind this claim by the president. You know, so many state election officials in both parties have rejected this claim. Do you also firmly reject the president's unfounded claims of widespread voter fraud in 2016?
Well, I welcome the president to sit down with us so we can walk him through the process so he understands the difference between fraud and perhaps some of the other challenges elections face that can disenfranchise people. Because if you talk about double voter registration, that's not considered fraud. Is it a good thing? No. There are many things that we want to work with the Presidential Commission on to be do better so that we can, again, reassure Americans that their vote is counted.
But
I'm not seeing the millions.
Okay, his claim of 3 to 5 million people voting illegally, you don't see.
Yeah.
You don't see.
I certainly don't see it in Iowa.
Okay.
I can tell you that.
Okay. Well, there are only 3 million people in Iowa. So
five. But we all count. We all count, Ben.
Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, Secretary.
All right.
All right. When we come back after a short break, Iowa Public Radio's Amy Mayer on a case of mad cow disease in the country, and the alarm bells that sets off. We'll talk about how the lack of rain and heat are impacting corn and soybeans, and remembering the moon landing and the part Collins Radio of Cedar Rapids played in it. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of our News Buzz.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end our week of news. Still to come a little bit later. 48 years ago yesterday was the first moon landing. Did you know that Collins Radio in Cedar Rapids, Collins Radio as it was known then, had a big part in the moon mission? We'll hear about that from someone who worked at Collins Radio in Cedar Rapids and remembers that first moon landing very clearly. But first, a case of mad cow disease has been found in a cow in Alabama. Joining us to talk about the red flags, the warnings that set off. Amy Mayer, Iowa Public Radio reporter. Hi,
Hi, Amy. There. Hi, Ben.
So, when we hear mad cow, we get very worried. What was about this? What happened? How was this discovered in Alabama? And in only one cow, right?
Only one cow, correct. And there are routine screenings that happen, and this cow presented certain indications that there may have been a neurological problem with the animal. So whenever that happens, these cows are screened for BSE, mad cow disease. There's two different kinds of the disease, and this cow had the one called atypical BSE, which has never been found in a human. And so it's not the one that years ago, particularly in the UK, caused infections that were fatal in humans. Mm-hmm. This cow in Alabama did not have that kind. It had the other kind. But the same surveillance measures are used and would identify either one.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts in the reporting on how this would happen? One cow among, well, I guess millions of cows.
Right. And this is only the fifth time since these surveillance measures were put into place a couple decades ago that a cow in the U.S. has been identified as positive. Scientists have an understanding of how these two kinds of BSE differ, and that has a lot to do with how it shows up. In the case of the classical BSE, which is the kind that historically did infect some humans, they were able to trace back the infection in the animals to contaminated animal feed. And the ingredients in that feed that infected the animals are now prohibited and have now been prohibited for more than 20 years.
They were, in fact, not vegetable, but they were animal products being fed to the animals, right?
Exactly. So bovine animal products, cow parts that were mashed into meal and used in feed, if they came from an animal that carried the disease, could then be passed on to another animal. Mm-hmm. That's no longer allowed in cattle feed. With atypical BSE, the kind that they found this week in Alabama, it appears to occur spontaneously. This is not a disease that is caused by a virus or a bacteria. It's called a prion disease. And without getting too technical, because I'm sure I'd make a mistake if I tried, prions are naturally occurring, but when they fold improperly, they can cause these neurological changes in the brain. And so they think that's what happened. And as far as they have been able to understand through research so far, this just can happen spontaneously in some animals.
Mm-hmm. And the only threat to humans is when it becomes a version of BSE called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So that's why we're really worried about it as well.
Right. That's the disease in humans that comes from infection from, a BSE-tainted cow. Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about the trade side of this. We export a lot of beef to the world. I understand that in your reporting that when this happened in 2003, a cow discovered with BSE, that there were some that stopped importing.
That's right. We have major trading partners in beef. And you're referring to back in 2003 when some of our trade partners like China, Japan, and South Korea put temporary holds on the importation of U.S. beef. I talked to a couple of economists this week, and they both, the two people I spoke with, one here at Iowa State and one at Kansas State, both said that they did not think this one incident of atypical BSE was going to have any ripple effects in the international trade of beef. And so far as I have seen, that has been the case. None of our trading partners has blocked importation of our beef.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also important to note that even though the disease that was identified is not the type that infects humans, this animal was nonetheless completely diverted from the food supply. So there was never a risk that this animal would have made it into the beef market.
Okay, very interesting. Amy Mayer, I remember this mad cow scare in the 80s, 90s as well. Living in Europe at that time, we remember it well. You mentioned the UK. The entire European continent was up in arms about this, and there are a lot of restrictions. To this day, Amy, I cannot give blood because I lived in Europe during the time of mad cow disease.
Well, quickly, I'll just tell you, I lived in South America as these were being lifted. And at the time in Argentina, they were trying to grow their international market for beef. And they were very proud that their beef had not ever been limited or contaminated. So different continents, different perspectives, same disease.
Thank you very much, Amy Mayer, with your reporting thoughts on the one case of in one cow of mad cow disease reported in Alabama. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, a recent court ruling could expand special education services to more Iowa students. Joining us to talk about that, Mackenzie Ryan, education reporter at the Des Moines Register. She's been covering it. Hi, Mackenzie.
Hi, Ben. It's great to be here.
Let's have you start off by talking about the case before the court of an Urbandale family. You describe in your reporting that they've fought for years to have their child tested to qualify for special education. Tell us the story of this family.
It's an interesting one. They homeschooled their two children, and when one of them reached fourth grade, they're not actually named in court documents. But when she reached fourth grade, they realized that she was really struggling and she might be in need of special education. So they enrolled AW, she's identified by her initials, in public school. And over the next few years, they had her tested multiple times. An independent evaluation found she might have dyslexia, so learning disability, which can make it very challenging for a student to read. But she never qualified for special education. At one point, the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics even strongly recommended that she receive an IEP, but she was never placed on one. And an IEP is an individualized learning plan. It's actually a legal document under federal law that spells out exactly what kind of services students should receive in school. It's put together by a team of experts, and it involves the parents and affords them certain legal rights, but she never received that.
Mm-hmm. So what was the case they brought? They brought a case, and the court sided with them.
They did. They brought a due process complaint under federal disability law, and they argued in front of an administrative law judge. And the judge ruled, they really sided with the family and held the Department of Education responsible. The family was awarded not only legal fees, but also about just over $1,000 worth of private tutoring that they sought in this time. And they also said that the department needs to change its rules and procedures so that what happened to this Urbandale family doesn't happen to other families.
Mm-hmm. So is it likely that the state's education department will appeal, or anyone will appeal, or is this where it ends?
The Department of Education has appealed to a U.S. District Court judge, and so a lot is yet to be seen in this case. I reached out to the Department of Education for comment, and they said that Iowa really does not solely focus on a label or a diagnosis, but rather on what kids need to succeed in school. And they point to a process that they rolled out in 2013 that really tries to individualize and get these intensive services to students who are struggling. And they're really looking for a determination in this case that how they are doing things, their procedures, do comply with federal law.
Mm-hmm. Of course, schools around the state watching this case, what could be some implications for Iowa schools?
Advocates have told me there could be several thousand more Iowa students who qualify for special education. I've been told that sometimes, effectively, students have to be in the 10th or even 12th percentile in order to qualify. And that can leave kids who are in the academic middle, who struggle with, say, a learning disability such as dyslexia, as in this case, without services. So they're really hopeful that the changes will be brought because of this case, and that more will be done to include a student's capacity to learn. They told me that especially with dyslexia, young students might come up with coping skills or strategies to get by, but they might be in that academic middle. And yet when they get older, material becomes more complex. It can turn into what they call a disastrous school experience.
Mm-hmm. I suppose from the school district point of view here, wanting to deliver a quality education, but also realizing that students with special needs cost extra money, I suppose.
It does. Now, both the federal government and the state pay for special education services through a mix of funding that comes in that's sort of targeted to these students. But what we've seen over the last few years, there was a study recently that came out that the number of students in Iowa receiving special education services have declined. That there might be a multiple reasons for that. But we are seeing, at least that one study found, that fewer students are receiving special education.
Mm-hmm. So in following this story, Mackenzie, what will you be watching for?
We're really going to be looking for what the U.S. District Judge decides in their ruling, if they're going to be citing and issuing a determination that the department's procedures can hold and do comply with federal disability law, or if the department needs to revise how schools and teachers are giving students this special education qualifications. Again, several thousand more students potentially could qualify, and that could really impact Iowa schools.
Okay, Mackenzie Ryan, thanks for your reporting on this, education reporter at the Des Moines Register.
Great, thanks, Ben.
It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you're not the only one who's been withering in the summer heat. So have Iowa's crops. Well, in some areas. Many parts of the state saw a good amount of rain overnight, perhaps in your area. Hopefully that helped. Let's get an overview of Iowa's crops on this July 21st from Mark Licht, assistant professor and extension cropping systems specialist with Iowa State University Extension. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon.
Give us the big picture of what crops across the state have experienced.
Yeah, so the heat and the lack of rainfall, quite honestly, is really starting to take a toll. Looking at the U.S. Drought Monitor, we're looking at moderately droughty conditions from northwest Iowa through central and down into south central southeast Iowa. Really, the best looking crops in the state are kind of in that northeast crop reporting district, and even part of the north central crop reporting district.
Mm-hmm. So, if I'm getting the picture right, so this kind of stripe from the northwest down to the southeast is the problematic area.
Yep, that's the problematic area. Again, that's where that moderate drought is. But even if you kind of look around that, about 20 to 25% of the state is in some sort of abnormally dry or droughty type of condition.
Mm-hmm. Are there parts of the state that are just fine or even getting more rain than needed?
So that kind of northeast Iowa area is doing really quite well. They're maybe a little bit on the deficit side of rainfall right now, but when we really started the main drought conditions and lack of rainfall, back in June, northeast Iowa was really receiving regular rainfalls, and so they're doing well right now. They have some of the best looking crops that I've seen in the state.
Okay, Mark, you get to be right now the precipitation or the rain genie, and you're going to tell me what the state needs to get into optimal conditions for our crops.
Well, I will tell you that in some cases, just because right now with corn we're in the pollination stage. The rain that some people received last night was very welcome. It definitely will help the corn through that pollination time frame and even in the early grain fill. As we look out into the next 2 weeks are going to be really quite critical. So it would be nice for all those droughty areas to get an inch rain, basically an inch of rain per week, in the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks time frame. But then even as we look at the middle to end of the grain fill period, it would still be nice to have some precipitation coming through.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the high nighttime temperatures. That's abnormal, isn't it? We've had some night temperatures that really don't dip below 80 degrees.
Yeah, and those are just as problematic as the lack of rainfall from the standpoint that, especially in pollination and in grain fill, whenever we have high nighttime temperatures, that crop has to use sugars or carbohydrates, that are generated during the day. They have to use that for energy in the evening hours. And so then that energy is no longer available for, that grain fill period. And then the other part of it is, not that we're, using carbohydrates for basically growth and sustaining the plants, But we're also speeding up, growth and development. And so the warmer those nighttime temperatures are, the faster we're going to go through, the early grain fill stages right now.
And when you talk about when you talk about grain fill, that's the size of the kernel or the bean.
Yep, exactly. So as that kernel or that bean grows, that's really that grain fill period that we're talking about. So on the early side of grain fill, a lot of times we talk and think about that as the size of the kernel or the volume of that kernel. But then as we get into the middle and end of seed fill, kernel fill, that's really looking at the weight of the seed or weight of the kernel.
Mm-hmm. What can you say about our main crops here in Iowa, specifically corn and beans, and regarding the weather? How are they each doing, generally speaking?
So generally speaking, soybeans are a little bit more resilient. They can withstand higher temperatures and drier conditions much better than corn can. Especially when we think about, kind of what's happening with both of them right now. Corn's in pollination and in that early grain fill now, when moisture is really needed, whereas soybeans, they'll start grain fill in 2 to 3 weeks, as we get into August. And then, that's when having moisture available for them is very critical. So, when the old saying that rain in July makes grain on corn, it's the rain in August that makes the grain on the soybeans.
All right. Thanks for your view, Mark Licht of Iowa State University Extension. We appreciate it, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming to the end of this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, 48 years ago this week, the first manned mission arrived on the surface of the moon. Here's a little sound from July of 1969.
Roger. And we're getting a picture on the TV.
You got a good picture, huh?
Okay, joining us to talk a little bit about Iowa's connection with that historic event, perhaps Iowa's connection with that actual sound and the fact that it could come back to Earth and be heard by us Earthlings. Mike Wilson is with us, former Vice President of Operations for what was then called Collins Radio in Cedar Rapids. Mike also worked for them for a time when it became part of what is known as Rockwell Collins. Mike Wilson, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
So, take us back to 1969. You were on that day. Well, let's talk about, first of all, before remembering that day, the landing, the successful landing, what was Collins Radio's involvement?
Well, Collins made the communications package for the capsule. So all of those radios, all of those voices from space came through on Collins radios.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what made that so difficult? Radio on Earth is one thing. Radio between the moon and the Earth is another thing, right?
Well, I think the most challenging thing was the reliability. Normally, we talk about average time between failures, and in the moon landing, there couldn't be any failures. So it had to be designed and built so that it would last for 2 weeks without failing. And I think that was the biggest challenge.
Mm-hmm. So what do you remember about the atmosphere at Collins Radio in Cedar Rapids?
Well, obviously, there was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of excitement as we built the equipment. We did have visitors from astronauts, and the factory people were pretty well motivated. And, of course, we were all on edge. We wanted to make sure it didn't quit. So we were really excited to make it work.
Mm-hmm. I understand that Collins was also responsible for the TV system, the pictures that were received back here on Earth.
Yes, kind of the interesting thing. Originally, NASA had not planned TV. And the Collins engineers convinced NASA there was enough bandwidth on those radios to do that. And I guess NASA did have to modify their ground stations, but because of Collins' probably insistence is really why we got that TV, which is kind of exciting.
Yeah. Do you know where that Collins radio equipment is today? Is that in some kind of museum?
Oh, I think it's all in museums. We got none of it back. We have a museum that has a lot of stuff, but nothing from the space. So I think the museum stuff really is in the probably in the capsules where the capsules are in the various museums.
So
they're pretty well looked for and guarded.
Mm-hmm. So the systems that Collins Radio built for the Apollo mission, on this mission in 1969, the first moon landing, did it all work perfectly? Were there any partial failures?
To my knowledge, there were no partial failures of any sort or kind. Now, each piece of equipment really had two sets of equipment inside the case, and so in case one quit, the other one would take over. But to my knowledge, we never did have a failure of any sort or kind, which is great, although that's kind of what we expected.
Yeah.
We were pretty proud of what we did.
Oh, you should be. That's amazing. Now, thinking back today, yesterday was the moon landing. On this day, 48 years ago, at this time, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong were getting ready to blast off from the moon back to get back up to that orbiter with, I guess, Michael Collins and come back. Tell me a little bit more about the experience. There are a lot of people listening, Mike, who were not alive or don't have a living memory of that. What was that moment like for you?
Well, I'll tell you, the exciting thing was if that didn't take off, if that rocket didn't light, they never would have come back. And they were, you know, down deep, had to be prepared for when they hit that button and that rocket didn't take off. So that was probably one of the highest stressful moments there was when they pressed the button to take off on the rocket.
Right. Pressing the button and having it not work meant you were not going home.
That was it. That was it. In fact, I guess they had already prepared letters and the president was prepared to talk to the widows, because that's what would have happened. It would have been a grim time, and we're sure great it didn't happen.
Right. We have just 20 seconds left. But, Mike, when you look at technology today compared to then, it must seem like you were working with maybe Model T technology compared to what we have today?
That's sure. And particularly in size, everything has gotten so much tinier and probably more reliable. We put radios in airplanes now, and they last like the wings. They last forever.
Mike Wilson.
It used to be Ed Chington.
We have to go. Formerly of Collins Radio. Thanks for your memories, Mike.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to participate.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Chelsea Hoy, executive producer Catherine Perkins. Monday on the program, the latest on sleep and sleep disorders with neurologist Dr. Eric Dyken. We welcome your questions and weird sleep experiences. Tune in Monday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.